tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
Welcome to In Tech We Trust. Who have we got on the podcast this week?
I'm Mark Farley.
I'm Lauren Malhoit.
I'm Nigel Poulton. All right then, HP is opening up its ArcSight telemetry system to third parties. Somebody is looking to take down the internet. We've got vVols and we've got a Microsoft storage array that can't do backups. Lauren, why don't you give us an introduction to this HP ArcSight thing?
Well, I thought this was interesting, Nigel, because I just keep reading about telemetry and analytics. It seems like that's what everyone's announcing. You know, we had Cisco Tetration, Arista announced CloudVision, Intel with Snap, and now ArcSight's opening up to third-party tools, basically, to allow more visibility into their networks. So I think this is kind of the hot new thing in an IT, right? Mark, you know a little bit about ArcSight, right? What are your thoughts here?
Well, it's interesting. This is a technology that HP acquired, I don't know, 7-8 years ago or so. And apparently, it's not software that went with the sale of HPE's software assets. So it's a surprise to see this. When you're doing something with software, we thought you sold that.
Does that mean it's good, then? Did they just sell the crap?
That's a great question.
I do wonder that. This is because if they've sold the software business, right, and I'm sorry to cut you off there, Mark, but it's like, it's either not software or it's good enough that they did. Did they just burn the crap assets?
Or they like couldn't offload it. It's so bad.
Oh.
Or maybe.
It could go either way.
Or maybe Micro Focus, the company that they offloaded to, didn't really have the wherewithal to deal with this kind of technology. I think this is software that HPE really wanted to keep. As Lauren was saying, there's this whole new class of large-scale analytics technology, large-scale telemetry products that are coming out. And it looks like it's going to be a big thing in the future. We don't know. I mean, that Tetration product that you guys have, Lauren, is a very impressive product. And, you know, people want to know what's going on in their data centers. They want to know if there's attacks going on. If there are attacks, can you replay it? Can you try to figure stuff out? These are going to be, I think, critical, mission-critical products, software products for any enterprise.
So, Lauren, is the Cisco Tetration product, is that open on the northbound side of things to third-party tools as well?
It is, yes. So the way we work is we'll put sensors in your host, meaning your servers or your VMs. We'll put sensors on the ASICs in the Nexus 9000s, and then we have third-party sensors that we can use. And then you can output information to, you know, various tools that you want to use with it.
I'm just wondering, like, is this HP's reaction to competition, right, maybe already doing stuff like this and thinking, you know, because are we at the stage in this kind of a product and a market where it's we're trying to claim territory, we're trying to put our flag down, and if you don't, or if you are open to like third party products and stuff, does that mean you've got a better chance of getting a foot in the door and off to a good start?
I think you're definitely right, even with, you know, I'm seeing it with SDN vendors opening it up to other ecosystem partners, layer 4 through 7 stuff, but then definitely with telemetry. And I think part of it, too, though, is that we have things like big data now and more bandwidth. We have 40 gig and 100 gig that can handle things from third parties, so we couldn't necessarily do all of this before. You know, we had to use SNMP, we had to use NetFlow, we had to do sampling of things. And I know at least with Tetration, I don't know with the other tools, just I'm not that familiar, we don't do any sampling, right? We take every single flow that goes through your data center to find out if it's secure, if there's anomalous activity, stuff like that. So I think it's a little bit of everything.
Yeah, and I know Intel Snap is an open source effort. I say Intel Snap, but it's Intel's kind of behind it, but it is an open source effort. And everything in the stack from hardware all the way up to layer 7 can report, you know, using Snap. And that could be just a massive amount of information. I think probably what happened here is HPE, to your point, Nigel, looked at Tetration and what Cisco was doing for UCS and said, well, we better do something similar here. And so here you go with this announcement.
Well, I want to pick up on one thing that you said about Tetration, Mark, was you said something along the lines of that is a fantastic product, right? Have you ever used those words to describe HP software? Ever?
I don't think so.
Okay, which is interesting to me, right? And I don't intend to have a pop at HP here, but they've had a history in the past of these as have a lot of the big vendors, right? Big bloated software products that just tried to do everything, and because of that were so unwieldy, and you know, you'd need like 6 mainframes just to power it. I'm still to be sold on just, I guess, any kind of big product like that. Maybe I should take a look at Tetration and Snap and some of these other things.
Yeah, they're very big and very expensive.
And very ugly.
You think there's a certain customer for it? Absolutely. I don't think it's going to go in every data center, at least not as it is now, right? But it's definitely an interesting solution, or they're all interesting solutions, I think. And it all started with that SIEM movement, right? I forget what that stands for, but that kind of security, what have you.
That's what security there.
Right, yeah.
Hey, so saying it's not for everybody, right? I've got a couple of laptops and a couple of MacBooks at home. What would it cost me to get Tetration in the office at home? I'm just kidding. You don't have to answer that.
Well, it's a full rack.
Is that right?
It's a 33-node Hadoop cluster.
39 nodes.
No, but it's 39 servers. I think it's a 33-node Hadoop cluster.
It's a 39-rack unit.
Right, okay. Not 39 racks, just 39 rack units.
So if you need 33 nodes of Hadoop cluster to analyze your laptops, Nigel.
Yeah, bit of overkill. Never mind. So next story, right? Somebody's trying to take down the internet here. So this is based off a story by Bruce Schneier, who, Lauren, you've read some of his books, right? He's a big guy in the security space.
Yeah, huge guy, written a lot of books. I even took a grad school security class, and he was one of the textbooks that we read. So, I mean, definitely, he knows what he's talking about.
Can I just stop you there for a second? Mark has written textbooks in the past, and I mean,
they're not grad school textbooks, Nigel.
It's not right, okay.
But you might be writing a grad school textbook right now.
It could be. We'll maybe talk about that later. So he didn't go into detail, and I think there were some of the things in the article. We will put a link to it in the show notes, actually, this week, where he said a lot of the stuff he was told was in confidence. He can't name the companies who have talked to him about this, right? But the essence of it was that key portions or key components of the internet, right, and holy cow, if there's anything central to the way that we live and do business these days, it's the internet, right? But key components of the internet are coming under systematic attacks, almost as if somebody is, like, probing and seeing what's secure and what's not, as if, like, building... this is doomsday stuff, right? But building a plan, like a master evil plan or something like that?
Yeah, one has to wonder if an attack gets to, you know, such a point, why doesn't it go further? And why are there themes and variations of the attacks? You know, it looks like they're experimenting with ways to, you know, manipulate or bring down sections of the internet.
The profiling, kind of. It's a good word. Figure out the weaknesses, yeah.
It is a good word, yeah. Now, I know that, like, help me out here, right? So the internet came out of a DARPA project, which was like advanced research project or something from the Department of Defense, I think, in the States, right? And certainly, at least when I was learning about the internet back in the day, it was drummed into me that the internet was designed to cope with failures and to be able to, you know, I always at least pictured in my head that there'd be like attacks on cities and places that would have like, you know, a key exchange that had routers and things like that, right? And the protocols would reroute and would learn, and it was kind of like Skynet, you know, or like the Terminator when you chop his arm off and he reroutes the ability to control his fingers through a different, you know. So it was kind of designed from the ground up to be able to deal with that. Yet at the same time, it can't deal with a simple distributed denial of service attack.
Well, I actually just heard a great podcast on this, and I don't remember what it was. I think it was actually like a Freakonomics or Wall Street Journal or something like that. Okay. But they had a guy on who actually developed the DNS system, because, you know, it was like Berkeley was literally called 1, and then the second site was literally called 2 at the time. But as we, you know, obviously it scaled out more, they had to add some sort of way of, you know, doing IP addressing, and then, of course, using words, being DNS. I guess when I think of it, it was just kind of, it grew, and no one had, like, a design for it, really. You know, and they just kind of figured it out as they went along. Kind of like networking in general, right? Like, oh, okay, we have layer 2, but now everything's getting stopped up, and there's collisions and all that, so let's create spanning tree. But now spanning tree is kind of screwing everything up, too, so how do we get rid of spanning tree, you know? It's kind of, like, developing as we go.
I think it's one thing to be like afraid of a nuclear attack, okay? That kills a lot of people. It's quick and it's painless for some people. It's long and drawn out and very painful for other people, and it has long-term impacts and what have you. But I've never thought, what would happen if, like, and it takes somebody with big old balls, right, to drop a nuke, and the repercussions are that, you know, somebody drops more on you and everybody, nobody benefits, right? But if somebody was to take down the internet, I mean, how painful would life be? We all appreciate, right, that applications run businesses, right? No application, no business for a lot of businesses these days. Take the internet out of the equation, not only are businesses shafted, I mean, it's painful, and it's like, we'd go into a depression. I don't mean as individuals, I would go into depression actually, but the economies would go into depression. It would be an almighty blow.
Let me ask you this, like, using as some sort of cyber attack, what if they just took out our power?
Well, so I've seen...
I mean, that would be...
I've seen films and TV shows, right, where there's like, they play on the idea that there's no electricity and we go back to using like hand tools and things like that. This is like not far off that. No internet.
You think about water, though. I mean, you think about everything that we use power to clean, to, you know, that's even scarier to me. I mean, okay, the internet's down and that sucks. Don't get me wrong. I'd be depressed too, but I would rather have that than... I would rather have no internet than no power.
But you can take power out to, like, one grid or something, I would say relatively easily, but to have a sweeping impact across the globe...
Mm-hmm. It would be an instant digital dark age.
Oh.
Yeah.
It'd be horrendous.
Good thing we don't have that smart grid everywhere yet.
Oh.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, we've become more and more dependent on all of this stuff, right? I mean... Good grief, we're using a Google Doc to power the podcast now. That would be no more.
We've stepped into 2010.
So, who's doing this prodding?
I mean, the natural reaction, isn't it, is to think China or Russia or somebody. I have absolutely nothing to back that up, of course. And I don't know. But I think in situations like this, you have to ask the question, who stands to benefit the most? And who would be hurt the most? And then back that up to be like, well, if the West, I'll call it, right, would be hurt the most, who wants to hurt the West the most? And that, you know, that there is a long old list there, to be fair.
Yeah.
And who's got the capability of doing it? It's probably not ISIS.
No, it's probably not. I don't think you can shake a stick at the root DNS servers and make them click.
Using smoke signals or something.
Yeah.
Oh, God. Now we're all targets.
But as well, it's like the resilience of the resiliency of the internet, right, is like maybe it would be relatively easy to, like, do a quick blow to it, you know, and it would recover in a day or a couple of days or whatever. And that would be bad. But I'm thinking, like, to take something down, like, mess it up for, like, weeks. I don't even know if that's possible because of the way the internet's architected.
Think of all the food I couldn't order delivered.
Man, you wouldn't get those burritos.
So we're figuring this is a nation state. And I remember working at Microsoft, you know, there were certainly concerns about nation states being involved and trying to poke, prod, hack around Microsoft. Lauren, do you have any experience with nation-state activity at Cisco?
Yeah, I know this is going to sound like a Tetration commercial. It's really not, and I didn't pay Nigel or Mark to talk about the product, but we did. We had Cisco IT running Tetration using only host sensors. We didn't even have the network sensors in yet, and they discovered some nation-state activity lurking there and immediately turned those records, because it has that DVR capability, immediately turned that over to the FBI, and now the FBI has that documentation.
Why didn't they just give it to WikiLeaks?
But that is freaking scary.
It is scary.
Well, you figure it's everywhere, then.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
You just know that it's literally on every single network out there.
Your four laptops.
Biggest one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, right? So I was back in London a while ago talking to my old boss and the network manager as well. And we were talking about Microsoft Azure and Amazon Web Services. And the network guy was like, honestly, I would never put anything... He's got no experience in the platforms, by the way. Great guy, excellent networking guy. But he's like... We are so secure in our firewalls. Nobody is inside of our firewalls. And we're like, you don't know that at all. And I don't know that they're not inside of AWS and stuff as well. But I'm massively of the opinion that, like, Azure and AWS and networks like that would pay the better security people to work for them and would invest more and would have a... I might be wrong about that, right? It's just an impression I've got. I'm thinking, like, if they've been in at Cisco, they must be able to get into just about any company.
Well, you think about it, it's great. You have all these firewalls. Even if you have, like, micro-segmentation set up and you've got everything isolated, what if your developers decide that it's such a pain in the ass every time you put in a new firewall that their application keeps breaking and they just statically put in their code to go around it?
Freaking developers, man, I'm telling you.
I mean, but it happens, right? I mean, they're... Firewalls are great, and this is why we need layered security, right? I mean, that's just the end of the discussion. I'm not blaming the developers, I'm not blaming the apps people, I'm just saying we need layered security.
And the more layers, the better, right? But the more layers, the more difficult it comes to get your work done as well, doesn't it? It's a challenge. Yeah.
And that's where the automation now comes in. It's easier, but it's still going to be a pain. But do you want to be Sony Pictures, or do you want to be Ashley Madison, you know? I mean, that's another... good, you know, where all the men were caught cheating.
That's what we're supposed to say. What's that?
Mark, you've gone sweating over there now.
We are in person this week, guys. If you hadn't figured that out yet.
Yeah. All right, then. So something a little bit less scary, but something that makes me roll my eyes, right? VVols. I mean, how freaking long have they been around? But there's been a good piece out there by Jeremiah Dooley, a person of considerable size balls, I think it's fair to say. Mark, do you want to give us an intro on this?
Yeah, he wrote a blog this week about VVol's implementations and what was a good one and what wasn't. And in the body of the three times he mentioned, quote, shitty implementations.
Right.
So he was talking about characteristics of shitty implementations. And the thing that's funny is in one of those things he mentioned three companies by name, EMC, NetApp, and HDS.
Sure.
And of course it's that
NetApp. Where does Jeremiah work?
He works for SolidFire.
Ooh.
A NetApp company.
Yeah. A man of considerable size balls, like I say.
No, he did talk about how wonderful, of course, SolidFire's VVol's implementation
was. Yes.
But still.
So I just want to clarify something there, right? So first of all, there are implementations of VVol's. Only 5 or 6 years after they were initially announced, right? So that's kind of like news to me, but they're shitty. So I'm interested. I remember the day when VMware, and they would announce VAAI and anything that VMware announced, right? They could dump a turd on stage and HP, NetApp, EMC,
certainly
HDS... They would crawl on the stage and they'd scratch it and sniff it and slap it on the side of their arrays and cover themselves in it and just to be on there with VMware. And that's not happening with VVols. Now, okay, so VMware is not the shiny company that it used to be anymore. That because of the success that they've had, right? I'm not popping at them there, right? Very successful company and things happen when you get successful, right? So have they lost their glamour appeal? Maybe VVols aren't everything they're cracked up to be. Or do these guys stand to lose something by having like a good VVols implementation? Is it in their interest to say, yeah, we do it, but look, it's not very good?
No, that's a good question, Nigel.
I don't know either. And I'm suspect of the VVols technology itself. Is it not that it's a bad technology, but is it an important technology, like you say? Is it something that we really need, I guess? You know, are customers really demanding it? I know they always ask array vendors whether they have it, but are customers even using it? So maybe it's just lower on the priority list as we move along our software-defined storage journey.
I always thought that, like, the idea of it was actually pretty good, but implementing it and how much customers would really, really want it, I was never quite sold on.
Yeah, like, what's the use case? I mean, what makes it so you have to have VVols and not just use, you know, LUNs or however we've been...
It's not compelling enough. Mm-hmm. That's what it's saying to me. So one last story before we move on to hot or not then. Mark, I know you used to work there, right? So StorSimple, acquired by Microsoft. How long ago, actually?
I think that was, 3.5 years ago?
Okay, right. And since then, I've not heard a great deal about it, right? I appreciate Microsoft's a big company with a lot of products and things going on. But I'm a little bit surprised, to be honest. However, they're in the news at the moment, failing to be able to complete backups, but backups to the cloud. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Simon Sharwood popped the story this week from Down Under. And it's interesting, when you don't get any news or nobody knows about you for all of that time, and then something comes out that says you can't back up,
That's
not necessarily a great story. The problem there is really what the machine is good at doing and what people expect out of it. You know, the product was developed to be a hybrid cloud storage solution that would have primary data but would back up all the change data every night to the cloud. And that's just the issue, because a lot of companies don't have bandwidth for that. They've got throttling built in. There's probably algorithms that are in that machine now that try to manage the network conditions. But what happens if you have more data that can be forced through the small pipe? It's the pig in the pipe problem, is my guess. I don't think it's anything else. When it gets down to it, this was a product that was designed in a way that would make it great for enterprise archiving. Because what you want to do is have old data go to the cloud and be able to access it. But in fact, using it as primary storage is not the greatest. I'll just say that.
Okay, thanks, Mark. So, Lauren, why don't you wind us out with a hot or not?
Well, obviously the Samsung Note 7. Is that hot or not, you guys?
Blazing hot!
Smoking!
Could you say explosively hot?
But is that or hot or not?
No.
It is the hottest thing we've ever had, I tell you. And we're all in agreement.
I'm taking my phone on my pocket right now.
Yeah.
It's not a Note 7, I'm just taking it out.
So I have a Edge 7. And my wife, because it's like an S7 and what have you, and this is the Note 7, she's like, really was kind of worried, and I'm coming on a flight and stuff like that. And I just picked up on the story, and I was like, oh, no. And I had to check that it was the Note 7. But there's quite a few of them it's happened to, which is pretty
scary. This is abysmal. This is horrible engineering on Samsung's part. It is inexcusable. Samsung is a company that took Qualcomm to task and decided to stop using one of their Snapdragon processors because it ran too hot. That happened a couple years ago. They knew this was a problem. They absolutely knew it. There's no way they didn't. They let the product go, and now they're dealing with it. At the same time, the iPhone 7 comes out, which is a product that people are complaining that it doesn't have a headphone jack. The product looks a little bit weak, but what does Samsung do? They just whiz all over themselves with an exploding phone. Good job, Samsung. Way to go.
So, guys, that's not our real hot or not, but, we couldn't go this week without mentioning it, at least. Especially as Nigel and I get back on planes tomorrow.
Yeah.
our real hot or not is Alphabet partnering with Chipotle, who also recently had some trouble with explosive things.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Chipotle had a biotoxin scare or whatever.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? So, right, just for our international listeners, right, because I was over in the States a month ago or so on holiday and had my first introduction to Chipotle. So it's like a fast food restaurant for like burritos and things like that, right? Let me tell you, I fell in love with the place. Now I'm scared.
No, it's a few months now, and they've done a lot of cleaning out and marketing and rebranding and all that stuff, and it is supposed to be all fresh.
So biohazard. I'm not going to start glowing in the dark.
No, it was E. coli.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Fair enough. Okay. Never mind.
So our true story here, though, is that Alphabet's partnering with Chipotle to deliver burritos via drones to people.
Oh yeah.
And they're testing their winch system on these drones and seeing how they can keep the burritos warm and what kind of packaging, and of course weight comes into play.
Uh-huh.
So what do you guys think, Nigel? Hot or not?
So Lauren, if a drone could cross the Atlantic and they could keep it warm enough, it will be hotter than the Samsung Galaxy Note 7, let me tell you. But generally speaking, I think all this kind of stuff is hot, right? So we talked about earlier, if the internet goes down, what happens to our life and stuff, right? And one of the things I thought was, I wouldn't have Amazon Prime anymore. And I am addicted to Amazon Prime's next day delivery. And this is like almost the same, right? I can just Chipotle.com or whatever, get me my favorite burrito, whiz it over to me while I'm working or whatever. Yeah, don't have to get in the car, don't have to do anything. I think stuff like that's major hot, yeah. It's the Amazon Prime, right? It's almost the exact same thing.
Same day.
It's great,
Mark, what are your thoughts?
I think this is super cool and cold. I mean, I love it. Everything about this I like, except I think it's completely impractical, will never work. The burritos will be frozen by the time they get to you, Nigel.
Oh, by the time they get to me, they definitely will.
And you look at the cost of this. What's the cost of this? The electrical cost? This is not efficient. Walk to your Chipotle. Get there some other way. Go with friends. Don't sit there by yourself on your patio, isolated from your neighbors, Nigel, and have a drone drop your fast food in your
lap. What does efficiency have to do with it, right? Because I'm happy. I'm the kind of guy, right, that's happy to pay more for something if I get it straight away.
Convenience.
For convenience, yeah. I would like, I don't agree with that, Mark. I would love
that. What about somebody that just comes to your door, a driverless car that comes to your door with a burrito?
Yeah, that'd be good. See, it would be rubbish if it wasn't, like, hot when it got to my house and stuff like that. They'd have to work out all of that kind of magic behind the scenes.
Lauren?
So, Mark, and I get to jump in here, but to give you an answer and also say my opinion, which I think this is also very hot...
Yeah.
So my friend and I had this idea that to deliver drones via burritos like 6 years ago, right?
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But, no, the caveat being, and this is where I answer your question, why not have just a car come to your house, whatever, deliver to drunk people, use the GPS on their phones while they're walking home.
Oh, my goodness,
and
Lauren.
And it comes from the sky as you're, like, downtown or whatever, you're walking from bar to bar.
That drunk person's going to, like, hit the enter key, like, 12 times. They're going to be attacked by drones.
You don't know how many times, like, if you're an orderer, you master that, no matter how shaky you are.
Lauren, that is genius.
Thank you.
There probably is something to that.
And it's trademarked, by the way.
Yeah. And on that note, let's wind the show out. So thanks, everybody, to listening. We are in the process of kind of changing up the way that we do the show, a little bit less banter, getting straight to the technical stuff. Maybe a little bit of get back to basics, you know, we're talking about... I mean, when was the last time we talked about VMware and vVols and stuff? It seems like it's been a while, so... making a few changes to the podcast. Hopefully we find them and you guys find them positive. By all means, like, come and tell us as well on Twitter, on our LinkedIn channel. When we occasionally get to that, we're going to try and be better with that as well. But thanks for listening.
Hey now, we are Ridecasting in Tech We Trust style. I'm Mark Farley with Nigel Poulton.
Yeah!
Hey!
It's nice actually to really be here in the car.
You are writing a book. What's up with that?
Do you remember when we, in IT, kind of got blindsided by Amazon Web Services? And there were all these developers that went out and had corporate credit cards and would buy instances on AWS and develop new applications in AWS. And suddenly, it would need to be production and in operations. And we don't run production in Amazon Web Services. Traditional sysadmin is, you know, been in the industry 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, or whatever. Understanding what it takes to run mission-critical production environments, right? And developers, some of them are great at the kind of operations side, but not so many. What I want is sysadmins to become as good at Docker as they are with Windows or with Linux or with VMware, right? We always talk about microservices and all these new architectures for containers, but containers can run traditional workloads as well, and you still get some of the benefits of containers there, the portability and all that kind of jazz.
Yeah, and I think we should expect to see traditional workloads being shifted over to containers.
I think we're going to, yeah.
What's the title of the book?
Right now, the title of the book is Docker for Sysadmins, Linux, Windows, and VMware.
So is it self-published, or do you have a publisher?
Yeah. So this time, the self-published route, you can make it your book, and you can say what you want, right? You can offend people if you want to. We can offend those DevOps guys and those developers. Not that we do, but I don't.
I think we offend people every week on the podcast.
Hey now!
Hey now!